You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
After the collapse of the Soviet Union, America's position as the world's sole superpower seems assured. But a lot has changed in recent years, and the next president will have to deal with a much weaker American economy, a crumbling infrastructure, two difficult foreign wars, and the rise of two new rival powers, China and the European Union. Parag Khanna, the director of the Global Governance Initiative and senior research fellow in the American Strategy Program at the New America Foundation, weighs our prospects in his new book, The Second World, Empires and Influence in the New Global Order. It's published by Random House. I'm very pleased it has brought Parag Khanna to the show today. Hello.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
It seems to me that for at least a half a century, pundits have been predicting America's decline and fall. You have a slightly different thesis. You're saying we're not going to decline and fall, but something else is going to happen and will be diminished.
Right. Well, let me say two things about that. First of all, pundits may have been declaring America's demise for half a century, but certainly in the 1990s, you didn't hear a lot of those pundits. In the 1990s, you heard America is triumphal. America is the sole superpower in the world, and it doesn't look like there's a rival in sight.
So both of those were misguided?
Absolutely. It's a far more balanced picture. And I don't argue that America is in permanent decline. I'm not a declinist as such, although some would like to characterize or caricature me that way. It's really a much more subtle picture of a world in which, during that same 1990s period when we saw ourselves as triumphal or triumphant and ruling the world, so to speak, globalization was happening. And globalization was rapidly empowering China and the European Union and other powers to rise very quickly in their level of power and their economic influence and their spending on global reach and their diplomacy. That has been happening. And what we see now, because you asked, is this just on the horizon or happening? No, it's here today. My entire book is about how wherever you go in the world, you will find that the European Union and China have a great deal of influence everywhere, and to a greater or lesser degree than we have, but just depends on where. But they're already superpowers. This is not something that's about a decade from now. It's about today.
So you're talking about multipolarity. And if things even up even more, apolarity?
Right. Well, multipolarity, the problem with the term is that it sort of connotes a rigid balance of power between three sort of static, unified, monolithic powers that are jockeying for influence in a zero-sum kind of world.
A modern version of what we saw during the Cold War.
Exactly, right, or even 19th and centuries prior. What we have today is a bit different because these aren't just three sort of, again, static, monolithic superpowers. They are three different systems. I call them imperial systems with their own kind of gravity. And they can blend and overlap in different ways. So it's not so much about that strict multipolar competition. Apolarity would be if none of them were superpowers.
So would you call them the first world? And because the title of your book is The Second World.
That's right. Well, no, China obviously isn't a first world country. In a way, the title refers to the socioeconomic terminology about first world and third world, but there isn't a second world anymore. Second world used to just mean socialist countries, but the way I redefined it, a second world country is a place that's sort of schizophrenically divided into a first world and a third world or components at the exact same time. But the second world are also these very strategic countries where America, Europe, and China are vying for influence.
And you have a lot of countries on your list. You traveled to 40 of them and you didn't cover them all.
No, I didn't. I don't even think I covered half of them in this book.
So there are 80 second world countries. Some of the ones that are probably more prominent: Ukraine, Turkey, Venezuela, Colombia, Uzbekistan, Brazil, Libya, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Malaysia, Indonesia.
To name a few, those are some of the most important examples of second world countries.
And you travel to over 40 of them. One of the refrains that you heard repeatedly was that they would no longer be listening to the United States but doing things their own way. Now, how is that any different from what the non-aligned nations used to say during the Cold War?
Right. There's one huge difference. The non-aligned countries said they weren't going to choose any side. What second world countries do is they multi-align. They choose all sides at once. They're out there getting aid and investment from Europe. They're out there cutting deals in a similar way and also militarily with China. And they have relations with us. So they're playing all sides at the same time. It's quite different, actually, from the non-aligned movement.
Well, Venezuela's doing that?
Venezuela does it quite well. Europe is actually its largest investor. We are its largest purchaser of oil. And China is coming in investing a lot in refurbishing its energy infrastructure and in social programs and so on. So there is a that is an example, like many others, that is trying to get something from everyone.
And Hugo Chavez can say whatever he says in his speeches, but this is the way he's actually running the country.
Absolutely. He'll never actually escape dependence on America as an export market, but that doesn't mean that he can't stay afloat by the support that he gets from Europe and China.
Can you explain some of the predictions about the Second World? For example, Malaysia. You say its future looks bright because it's cultivating good relations with both the United States and China.
It's certainly doing that, but that's not the only reason why its future looks bright. Its future looks bright because of domestic considerations as well. It has invested a lot in its infrastructure and its education and other areas. Certainly it helps that it is sort of deepened economic relations with China while also having very strong economic and military relations with the United States. So it has managed to stay friendly with all sides and therefore remain very peaceful and stable.
Well, since the United States has complicated economic relations with China, why would we even be surprised by that?
We shouldn't be surprised by, are you referring to Malaysia or to just the U.S.-China
relationship? The U.S. and China are so tied together these days that every time anything goes wrong, any time a drug goes wrong, we immediately say, well, China did it.
Right, and that's a good point. A lot of people do believe it's sort of a Tom Friedman argument, if you will, which is that economic interdependence makes conflict highly costly and potentially unlikely, and it also makes us see the positive aspect of our relations more than negative. The truth is that we have cooperation economically, but we also have a lot of friction on the strategic, political, and economic levels as well, also happening at the exact same time. It's just what you choose to emphasize.
Now, Indonesia is one of the most populous countries in the world. You describe it as a sprawling waterborne golf course in which a mix of foreign companies and countries claim ownership of different holes.
Yes. That, I actually think, is an accurate description of...
It's almost like China at the end of the 19th century.
In a way, although Indonesia is geographically, as I describe it, it isn't really a unified territorial state by any means. It is an archipelago of over 14,000 islands, and it never really has had sovereign, full, complete control over that territory. It has been sold off in parcels to corporations in foreign countries for development, because otherwise it wouldn't be able to afford its own development. This is the reality of these kinds of countries today. It doesn't make sense to speak of Brazil, because you have a huge Amazonian rainforest that is also parceled out and owned by different corporations or is logged without any regulation. And then, of course, you have powerful coastal cities like Rio. So, you know, a lot of these Second World countries aren't really, it's just not sensible to me anymore after having spent so much time traveling to them to think of them as one place, especially when you consider the difference that always exists between cities and the countryside. And that gap is what epitomizes the Second World.
My guest is Parag Khanna. His book, The Second World, Empires and Influence in the New Global Order, is published by Random House. Taiwan always strikes me as an odd case, one of the most successful economies in the world right now. But is it an independent country or is it part of China?
Well, it's both, right? It has a certain diplomatic standing, though not holding an official seat in the United Nations, but it operates its own, it has sovereign control over its own economy, but its economy is increasingly dependent on the economy of China, in which there is a great deal of mutual investment. And so that's, you know, your question is a valid one. Is it really an independent country or is it not? I treat it like a stateless, I think I call it a stateless economic node, and I think that is actually what it is. It isn't an independent country, but it is an autonomous economic actor.
What about the future of Egypt, for example, which should be doing better but has suffered under a string of repressive regimes?
Well, a string, you only need to name one, because the one that it has now has been in power for a quarter of a century. Most Egyptians who are under the age of 30 really only have known this one leader, Hosni Mubarak, and a lot of them would like to see his days, you know, sort of numbered. which age will probably take care of, more than any military sort of action on our part or something like that. But, this is
Will that free the country up?
No, it won't. No, it won't at all. It's certainly convenient to point to him, and he certainly represents a great deal that's wrong with the country when it comes to political corruption and stasis and lack of reform. But again, this is one of these classic second world situations where you can't say the future of Egypt is. You can say Egypt has a stock exchange now, there's a growing middle class, some people are doing very well, there's real estate developments coming up outside of Cairo, they've discovered natural gas in the Nile Delta. But you can also say Egypt, that's a country where they're too dependent on tourism, their Nile is drying up, and it looks more like a swamp than a mighty river, and where there's a huge youth population that's increasingly restive and unemployed. Both things are happening.
So is it a second world country or a second world country verging on being a third world country?
It's sort of on that borderline.
Mm-hmm. And a number of countries are. We'll get to the big surprising one as far as I was concerned in reading this book, Russia.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder about your background. You were born in India, grew up in the United Arab Emirates, lived in Germany and the United States. Is that why has that influenced your thinking?
Of course it has, yeah. I mean, I've been addicted to travel, basically. I've had this Wanderlust since I was born. And obviously, being able to write this book and travel has only encouraged that.
Now, you write, to a large extent, the future of the second world hinges on how it relates to the three superpowers, and the future of the superpowers depends on how they manage the second world. That also suggests that they're going to be able to deal with each other pretty evenly.
The second world countries?
No, the three superpowers. Are they going to be able to deal with these second world countries smoothly without dealing with each other as well?
No, in fact, and that's precisely why I believe that we can say that we are the one dominant global superpower, all we want. But if you look country by country, and again at the most strategic second world countries, and you see their leanings and alignments shifting away from us and towards a more balanced kind of picture with other superpowers, then it's really no longer truthful to say that we control the world or we are the hegemon.
Well, the United States offers military protection and the promise of democracy and human rights, to some degree undermined by recent developments. The EU offers the prospect of membership in the world's most successful economic club, and China talks trade, investment, and infrastructure projects. They all seem attractive, but right now, is the United States the most hurt because it's offering the least, really?
It's not that we're offering the least. When we do provide a serious package, if you look at, for example, countries that are actually receiving funds from the Millennium Challenge account, that's a huge shot in the arm of funds, of investment, of support and assistance to those countries, which they very much need. So when we sort of adopt a country and really give it a full service of packages and really provide a lot of expertise, then that country can really benefit. But when they get more or less piecemeal aid packages where a lot of the money is just recycled back to American contractors, then we're really not doing a lot. So what you're seeing across Africa is countries saying, working with China has yielded actual tangible results. We have that dam built. We have that school. We have that new ministry. We have that road. We have that mine opened. All that stuff is getting done a lot faster than when we said we were going to do those things. So we are getting a run for our money. We are being shown up. And we have to be more efficient and tighten our belt a bit in order to compete.
And China is more willing to work with countries like Sudan than we are.
Right, exactly.
My guest is Parag Khanna, K-H-A-N-N-A, who directs the Global Government Initiative in the American Strategy Program of the New America Foundation. And he has written for many publications. In fact, you may have seen an article he wrote that dealt with similar stuff, although it didn't cover his travels, in the New York Times Magazine in January. It was the cover story, Who Shrank the Superpower? We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Parag Khanna, who has written a book called The Second World, Empires and Influence in the New Global Order, published by Random House. You traveled for 2 years in preparation of this book?
That's right.
Do you have to go there to understand what's going on?
Yes, absolutely. I don't think the book could have been written without spending that time on the ground.
Now, okay, we've talked about the first world, or this, what has been called the First World and the Second World. What about the Third World? Are the countries of the Third World stuck in the Third World? Is there a way for some of them to move up into the Second World?
They are, for a certain time horizon. I chose to focus on countries which, for the next, 10 years or so, are the ones whose transition is happening most rapidly. And it could be an upward transition or a downward transition, but that transition is underway right now. These are the most dynamic countries. The Third World is obviously less dynamic and less likely to succeed in the next decade or more.
And what holds them back?
I mean, a lot of factors. Depends on where. What holds back India, for example, is its massive population and inefficient government and a host of other geographic and environmental kind of factors. Africa actually is held back for a similar set of reasons, but also it has a post-colonial situation where borders and ethnicities and polities don't match up very well. So the Third World is held back by a great variety of things. A lot of people blame American and European farm subsidies for holding back the Third World. But all of these factors, in a way, just conspire to a greater or lesser degree to kind of ensure that the Third World isn't going to be that major diplomatic factor that I try to focus on.
You say that aid packages and foreign service yields more for a superpower than military aid, and the European Union and China don't spend the same amount of their GDP on the military, although China has just announced major increases on military spending. So have they misunderstood how this works? Did they not read your book?
Oh, no. China does spend a great deal in the military, and we don't really know how much. Projections vary drastically on how much China spends. But remember that they can always justify it because they can say that they're surrounded by powers such as Korea and Japan that are technologically more advanced than they are and that are American allies. And then, of course, the American Navy itself sits on its shores in a variety of ways and supports Taiwan and so forth. So they will always be able to justify their defense expenditures by way of saying that they're in fact weaker than everyone else.
Another country that sells a lot of military material is Russia. Now, Russia doesn't seem to fit into your view as either a first or a second world country. Currently, there seem to be two prevailing views on the future of Russia, that it will return as a superpower. And I think that's one of the reasons that Vladimir Putin has been elected and reelected, or his or people who represent him. And then the other one says it's in a state of steady decline from which it will never recover.
Well, Russia very much is a second world country. In my book, it's actually the archetype almost of a second world country. I call it the ultimate swing state, a second world swing state, just like the others. I have it's so big that I had to divide it into four parts and treat it in two different sections of my book because it is so vast and consequential. But it isn't a superpower. A superpower is a country that can and does attempt to shape events and decisions all over the planet. You don't hear people in Argentina and Chile talking about what their relations with Russia are, but you do hear them talking about China and Europe. And that's what I mean when I say a superpower. So Russia isn't that anymore. But
if its economy is booming, won't it get to a point where it can become a superpower again?
But if you could choose one country in the world whose economy is the same size as Russia's, guess what it would be? It's France or Korea. That's how big the entire Russian economy is. I just want to repeat that so it's perfectly clear. Russia's entire economy is not larger than that of France. So it really has shrunk tremendously, both geographically, of course, as a result of the dissolution of the Soviet Union, and economically it fell quite precipitously in the early 1990s. It has a long way to go before it can revive itself into a so-called superpower.
And you talk about blocks of houses that stand empty because of the exodus of populations in the former Soviet Union to other nations.
But of course, the decline of Russia's population isn't just because of migration internally and the exodus out of the country. It has also a lot to do with disease and poverty across Russia that is led or combined to make it one of the countries with the fastest rate of population decline in the entire world.
Where do India and Japan fit into your global view?
They, like Russia, are also swing states. I consider Russia, India, and Japan to be three very strategic swing states. India is, of course, more third world in development. Russia is second world, and Japan, of course, is a first world country. But strategically, they are these swing states which are simultaneously becoming or India, in India's case, for example, becoming a closer U.S. ally, although it hesitates to do so. Japan is obviously a historical U.S. ally. And both of them are deepening their relations with China economically very much. I write about the Japan-India-Australia triangle, and that is the strategic East Asian zone. And China sits at the center of that and is trying to maintain very friendly ties with those corners of the triangle. So it's focusing a lot on mending relations with India and doing joint projects with them, and buying up Australian natural resources as much as it can, and with a lot of investment from Japan as well, to try and keep them from becoming too pro-U.S.
Doesn't Japan have a rather grandiose view of itself?
Not necessarily. I mean, domestically speaking, of course, there's a lot of political and economic malaise in Japan today. It considers itself, it is a very powerful economic state, of course. It has the second largest economy in the world of a country, or third largest if you treat the European Union as one economy. So it is very powerful. And in a way, Japanese investment and money and technology has been a very strong factor in China's rise, because Japan does invest so much in China. It's one of those things that people forget when they say, oh, China, Japan, they're rivals, they hate each other. Well, look at the numbers. It's not quite that way.
China and Europe are all pursuing Central Asia because it has huge oil and gas reserves. Where does the U.S. fit into that picture?
That's very interesting, because we don't border Central Asia, obviously. It's a landlocked region that borders Russia, China, and Europe, reaches it over land through across the Caspian Sea or across Turkey and the Caucasus. So, you know, Central Asia is a very tricky area for America to have influence in. We have bases in Afghanistan. We've had them in Uzbekistan, but closed them, and a small base in Kyrgyzstan. And there's just a lot of jockeying and maneuvering for influence. Our bases most certainly don't equal a great deal of influence in these countries, and not even in Afghanistan, as we're learning the hard way right now. So we have a permanent geographic uphill battle to fight to be very influential in Central Asia.
Is one of the problems in Central Asia that most of those countries are Muslim countries? And right now, most Muslim countries don't look all that kindly upon the United States?
No, I think because a lot of these countries are still led by post-Soviet era leaders who are actually anti-Islamic fundamentalism or even Islam, that is not the reason. It has a lot more to do with national interests, with the personalities of these leaders, with the pressures that they face from Russia and China, and their economic incentives and corruption, than it has anything to do with Islam at all.
Parag Khanna's book, The Second World, Empires and Influence in the New Global Order, is published by Random House. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What about the countries where radical Islam is a major factor? You write that economic well-being trumps ideology. Does it work with those people as well?
It depends on where. We have countries where economic development does create disincentives for radicalism. And again, you also can't treat the Islamic world as anything like a monolithic entity. I go to great lengths to not use the term Islamic world in my book. Even the Arab world, or the so-called Middle East, is really fragmented into really different geographic clusters, North Africa, the Levant, and the Gulf. And even there, you have a huge discrepancy or difference in the kinds of regimes and states. You've got monarchies, you've got authoritarian regimes, and so on. So there's no one way to describe or capture the way in which Islam plays out in these countries. There's places like Morocco, which is a monarchy but has Islamist parties whose platform is more or less pro-democracy and anti-corruption and pro-foreign investment. So that doesn't really fit the model of what we think of as, you know, sort of Islamic political action. And the Muslim Brotherhood really hasn't lived up to the fears that it is somehow going to radicalize Egyptian society, because it really represents what ought to be America's declared rhetorical pro-democratic position. So there's a lot of contradictions in the way we understand political Islam.
Well, you've said in interviews that quite a few studies have shown that terrorists largely come from the middle class and are pursuing very clearly articulated political objectives of resisting authoritarian regimes and American-backed aggression. Are you saying that Al-Qaeda doesn't have a strong authoritarian streak, that it's based on a democratic impulse?
Al-Qaeda is not a political party in any country that I'm aware of. So I'm not referring to Al-Qaeda at all. I mean, I'm talking about legitimate Islamist political parties. Al-Qaeda is, of course, a transnational terrorist organization. It has political viewpoints both globally and in different countries where it attempts to shape politics by way of attacks, assassinations, bombings, and anti-American activity. But that doesn't make it a political party.
Well, but it seems to me the bind that that radicals have in some of those countries is that on the one hand they reject everything that's Western, and on the other hand they're using cell phones and they want everything that's Western or want the things that are Western that they like and not the things they don't like. So women should dress modestly, but at the same time they should be able to drive good cars.
Right. Well, technology and modernity have that effect. What happens is that we used to believe that because we invented something and spread it around the world, therefore it makes these countries pro-American, like McDonald's and Hollywood are everywhere, therefore the world is pro-American. Obviously, that failed to live up to reality. So what I find is that, as I said earlier, globalization has really helped China and Europe rise and coalesce and do things their own way. Well, technology and modernity have also kind of been divorced from America, and people can use them however they want, including terrorists.
So there are some American politicians who say that the European Union will always have problems because the economies are based on socialist theories. You obviously disagree.
Well, yeah, I do disagree that they're always going to have problems because they are social democratic in nature, whereas we are more free market in nature.
Although I'm not sure we are all that. We have Medicare, Medicaid. We have any number of socialized programs,
sure,
don't we?
Sure, we do. And for those who have them, they have it universally. We don't have it universally. We spend a lot more out of inefficiency and deliver less to the average citizen in healthcare than they do. With their approach. A lot of Europeans, of course, as you know, condescend to and mock American policies because our population isn't as healthy on average as that of the European Union.
Some of your assessments about Russia's decaying from within could be applied to this country. We have this growing gap between the rich and the poor, the declining value of the dollar, growing indebtedness. All problems that we see in Russia.
And most certainly also a declining infrastructure that really needs a huge amount of investment to be restored or renewed, regenerated. That needs to happen in this country. Technology has to always be sort of updated and upgraded. And you have countries in the Middle East and in East Asia that are buying next-generation technology now. Their broadband penetration rate in some East Asian countries is higher than that of the United States.
So what are we going to do here? You're not a fan of the current administration's foreign policy. Do you think that that has undermined our position in the world?
It certainly has, but I really emphasize as much as I can that what is happening now was more or less inevitable. We were not going to live in a world that's simultaneously globalized and also dominated by America. Globalization does not allow centralization to happen. You can't control it, and we can't control it. So I really go out of my way to point out that this was going to happen anyway.
Whether we invaded Iraq or not?
Absolutely, yeah. The changes that I'm talking about, again, began with the liberalization, globalization of the 1990s, not with the Bush administration. Because we may have been ignoring the rise of China, that doesn't mean that it wasn't happening.
Was it also a sense of false security based on our military might?
Most definitely. I think to this day that still pervades some of the debate. The notion that we are have the most powerful military in the world still leads a lot of Americans to believe that it therefore means that we can get what we want. But I think the last 8 years have shown repeatedly that that's not the case, that foreign policy is a combination of economic, military, diplomatic, other kinds of strategies. And if we only use one strategy, we actually will not succeed.
Are you working for one of the political campaigns?
I've been an advisor to the Obama campaign, focusing mainly on South Asia.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that he would be all that different than Hillary Clinton or John McCain in regard to South Asia?
Well, it depends on the country, it depends on the policy, and so on. So it's hard to be very specific about that. Obviously, the Democratic Party in a number of ways represents a different approach. And there are a lot of circumstances such as Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, where we're simply more reactive to the situation than we are shaping it at the moment. So I can't say that any one man is going to be able to turn on a dime because they're pulling us. Those situations are dragging us more than we're shaping them.
Would you have called Iraq a second world nation before the fall of Saddam Hussein?
Yeah.
What about Pakistan, which seems to be everywhere? Where? How would you... is Pakistan a third world country?
Yeah, it is, more or less, yeah.
Why is that? Because it seems to be functioning, and it has its own nuclear weapons. Wouldn't that automatically...
So does North Korea. again, you know, the second world is a tricky concept. It's simultaneously a domestic socioeconomic one, but it's also a strategic one. So I do write about Pakistan in my book precisely because it is one of the most strategic countries in the world today. So I do deal with it at some length.
Do you think that more democratization would allow that country to flourish a bit more? Right now it's pretty much controlled economically and every other way by the military.
That's right. I mean, what we are witnessing right now is a slow decentralization of politics away from the military. But politics doesn't necessarily overlap with how the country is run. As you pointed out, the military still has a vast command of the resources in the country and shaping the political arena a lot. So, for example, in this last election, we did see a restoration of some civilian power and influence in the country, but we didn't necessarily see the stabilization of the entire country. You still have what I consider to be three different poles of power. You've got the military, you've got the civilian opposition parties, and you have Islamist groups. They still haven't reconciled with each other, and this last election hasn't promised that either.
What do you think the next president has to do to restore the economy? To make the dollar a little stronger? Or is that even something that a president should be hoping to do?
Well, it's something that shouldn't depend on the next president at all. I mean, our economic policy is something that, like foreign policy, should reflect a certain continuity and a desire for our position to be balanced with what's happening in the world.
So, is that how it works?
Unfortunately not, no. But that's what I was taught in school, and I still cling to the notion that foreign policy is supposed to be something that's more nonpartisan. It's about the national interest, not about partisanship. And that's kind of what students of diplomacy are taught, and that is what diplomacy is ideally supposed to be. But partisanship has really infiltrated right into the very core of how diplomacy is practiced today. If you look at the way in which political appointees have shaped policy and have become more the mouthpiece of the president rather than providing independent kind of assessment and a stable, continuous course to policy, that unfortunately is just the reality of the way policy is done today.
Parag Khanna, P-A-R-A-G-K-H-A-N-N-A, his book, The Second World, Empires and Influence in the New Global Order, published by Random House. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.